And we're live.
All right.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very, very, I can't emphasize, very special episode of Fans of Power. For people who have listened to this, they'll know what I'm talking about. We have a very, very special treat for you guys here. For those who listen to the show regularly, I'm a tremendous fan of the live-action movie from 1987. Joe is as well.
Yes.
And we've been very fortunate to land Mr. William Stout, who was very gracious enough to give us some of his time to reflect on, for a lot of us, a very special movie since childhood to adulthood, who worked on this film, was there from the beginning to the end, and we really just want to pick his brain and just elaborate on this at times very chaotic filming. You know,
yes,
we can't wait to dig into that part in particular there. So thank you, William, for being here with us.
Hey, happy to be here. It was a really fun movie to make.
All right. Well, Joe, you ready to get into it here?
Yes, go ahead. Start off with the first question to him, and we'll just hit him back and forth. But yeah, I can't wait. I'm freaking out.
Well, I guess first off, Bill, I guess what we could start with is pretty much asking you, as your job as production designer, what did that entitle? Like, what, as a production designer with this particular movie, what does your job pretty much entail?
The way I define production designer is he is the guy or gal who is in charge of everything you see on the screen except for the performances of the actors. So under my domain were all the sets, the costumes, the special effects, the special makeup effects, set dressing, props. If you saw it on the screen, I was responsible.
Oh, man. Boy, you had a lot on your plate.
Yeah, typically when I'm a production designer, I have about 1,250 people working under me. And it's often primarily a managerial position. Usually the only time I have time to do any design work for the film is on Saturday and Sunday when everybody else is home. And then that means on Monday morning I can hand off art and designs to all the heads of my departments for them to start working on and building and painting.
Oh, wow. Now, I guess prior to He-Man, you had been working with Canon Films already on Invaders from Mars, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I urge everyone to see Electric Boogaloo. It's a terrific documentary.
I had it on bootleg before it came out available to buy, so I've watched it several times since its release. And I wish there was more of you and everybody else that was featured in it, because I was so hungry to hear more about Canon Films. And that, which leads to my next question, is what were your first impressions of Menahem and Yoram?
Well, it was like the Wild West. They were sort of kind of wild Israeli versions of Roger Corman in a way, in that the similarities that they had were, if you were a young filmmaker and you had an idea for a movie, you could get a meeting with Roger Corman or with Menachem and pitch them and get a yes or no on the spot. You didn't have to go through this whole chain of command like you normally do with a regular film studio. And if he said yes, you got your chance to make a film. You wouldn't get much money, but you get your shot. And I really appreciated that. I mean, it was an exciting time to be working in film in L.A., and especially working for Canon. The most pictures that any major studio had in production at that time, I think it was Warner Brothers with 6, and Canon had at least 60 or 80 going. It was unbelievable.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Now, I guess, too, with you've already had your foot in the door there, were you just kind of a logical choice to be put on the project, essentially? Because you weren't production designer just right off the bat at first, were you?
Well, I was the production designer. My first job as production designer was on an American Godzilla project that Steve Miner was producing and directing. And that was a dream project. I worked on that for 2 years, but sadly, we couldn't get the green light on that project. So after that, I became production designer for a film that's become a gigantic cult movie called Return of the Living Dead. It was the first zombie film where the zombies were fast, and it was the first one where they ate brains. And Jon Stewart used to quote the film on a weekly basis on The Daily Show. And then, actually, I was originally hired to be the storyboard artist on Masters of the Universe, and that's what I began doing. But Gary Goddard and I, we really hit it off. I can't remember if Gary and I had worked together before or not, but we certainly did a lot of work after Masters together. And we shared a lot of common enthusiasms, one being the comic book artwork of Jack Kirby. And so Gary and I spoke in a sort of shorthand. He would say, oh, Kirby that up a little more. And I know exactly what he was saying. I didn't have to ask him what that meant. But I started out doing storyboards, and every once in a while I'd slip in designs for some of the characters and things, and Gary really responded favorably to those designs, and we became closer and closer. And then the original production designer, Jeffrey, he left the production and recommended that I take over as production designer, and it was extraordinary. I found out at 10 a.m. in the morning that I was the new production designer, and by noon I was getting congratulatory calls from all over the film community in Los Angeles. I don't know how they found out so fast, but they found out before my family even knew. It was amazing.
Holy crap. Well, I guess Hollywood is just a real tight clique. I mean, everybody's just kind of friends in the
very small town.
Very small town, obviously.
Everybody knows everybody.
Now, I guess, what's the first thing that you initially worked on once you've landed this position here? I mean, obviously storyboard artist, but at what point does the concept drawings of characters and backgrounds and things like that kind of come into play?
Well, it's kind of a blur because I started out doing storyboards, and I had there was a great moment. Working right next door to me was the writer, David. And David came in to see what I was doing, and he flipped out when he saw the boards. He was so excited and so happy, and he started singing my praises to the rest of the company. And as I started to do other little designs and things, I think one of the first things I did is I designed the costume for Blade. I designed the Beast Man. And just before I was made production designer, I was back doing storyboards. And then when I was made production designer, then I started to tackle the big sets because I knew we needed to start building things. And so most of what I did initially, once I was production designer, was designing the major set pieces. And I'd worked on a lot of films before, and I knew that a lot of the stuff we were working on was going to be cut. And they cut about a third of the film. Originally, there was going to be a lot more taking place in Eternia, and I'd done a lot of designs for Eternia. But eventually, they cut all of that for budgetary reasons and had the film take place mostly on contemporary Earth in America.
Now, were these things cut before production started, or is the script just being greenlit and making decisions about the budget and things like that? Was this like an early decision before you guys even got rolling?
No, we were sort of flying by the seat of our pants. The script had been written, and I had started designing the Eternia stuff, and then that got cut. But that was cut before we started shooting. So okay. We didn't actually build any of that stuff because basically the budget wasn't there to do that.
Okay, I was going to say, now that would be my question, is all the characters, all the designs, everything that you came up with. Now, how much artistic freedom were you given? I mean, did they say they wanted something a certain way, or did they say, go ahead and run with it, you know, William, and see what you can do? Or how did that go about?
Well, the interesting dilemma that I had, or the problem that I had, was I knew in advance I did not want it to make the film look exactly like the toys. I didn't want the costumes to look like the toys because, a lot of the Mattel toy figures had interchangeable bodies, and you can't have that in the film. Everything has to be distinctive. And I wanted to I don't want to say modernize, but just make the characters look a little hipper and more natural, more realistic. I was extremely fortunate in being able to hire my friend Jean Giraud to help work on the film. He's better known to most people as Mobius.
Yes.
He was in Santa Monica. And one of the first things I threw at him, I said, how about you redesign He-Man? And he came up with this brilliant idea. And he gave He-Man a lot hipper haircut. He no longer looked like a member of ABBA. And he had this idea that since they're having this sort of worldwide battle, that He-Man would pick up scraps of metal and shrapnel and things that he'd find on the ground and strap them to his body as armor. I thought that was such a cool idea. So I incorporated that. I did. he did his take on He-Man, and then I did my overlay on that and softened it just a little bit because I knew Mattel was not going to be happy about what we were doing, and they weren't. But we needed to drag He-Man into a much more hip and modern era and more believable. Quite frankly, if we'd made it exactly like the toys, it would have been sort of silly and goofy.
No, I could see that. You're right. Because, I mean, you know, there was the fans that said, oh, God, it didn't look just like the cartoon or the toys. But, I mean, you got to expect to see something looking different. And I think that the ideas that you both came up with, you know, were fantastic, especially the combination when you said of what you and Mobius did to create, you know, that He-Man look. Now, as for other characters and things, now you came up with the designs for, like, Blade yourself and Karg, and that was all your vision, correct?
That was also the character we call Little Pig Boy. That was
the
contest winner. That was designed in about 15 minutes. I mean, I came to work and they totally blindsided us. They didn't tell us there had been this costume and that we suddenly had this kid there on set who was expecting to be in the film. And so I designed his little mask and costume really quickly. And Julie Weiss, the costume designer, she started making it right away, and the makeup guy started working on the mask, and so it was ready that day. It was amazing how fast
it was done. Oh wow, that quick. Yeah, because I mean, the poor kid, it sounded like he almost didn't make it into the movie then, huh?
Yeah.
All right, well, I guess one of the other big designs and things is like Castle Grayskull itself, or like the inside, the interior, and everything. Now, how did you even think of this massive design? I mean, because that is one gigantic set that you guys came up with.
It is. In fact, it was the biggest set that had been seen in Hollywood in about 40 years. We were working at Laird Studios, which used to be the old RKO Studios, and then later the Desilu Studios. So it was where they shot Citizen Kane and King Kong. And I took two huge sound stages and knocked out the wall between them to give me one gigantic stage. And that was where we set the throne room. And boy, the word got out about this colossal set. And so everybody in the film business was coming by to see it. And they all wanted their pictures taken seated on the throne to all the power in the universe, of course. And it became the most popular photo op that year in Hollywood. It was extraordinary.
That had to be an amazing feel. I mean, God, to create one of the biggest sets, like you said, in 40 years. Yeah, that probably was overwhelming and also just gave you guys a fantastic feeling. But I know Tyler. Now, Tyler, you probably want to expand more about stuff about the Grayskull interior. Tyler, why don't you go ahead now?
Ever since I saw you in the mini documentary about the film that the guys behind the I forgot what it's called. There was a He-Man documentary done a few years ago that has not been seen the light of day yet. And I've watched it so many times now, and now that I've just off the top of my head, I've just forgot the name of it. But you had mentioned that you had designed the Grayskull set with there's a lower level that obviously is you see shots of it, but you don't see the actual below that you designed for the big sword fight that obviously got cut down greatly, and I was so fascinated by that. I'm like, oh my gosh, like what else is down there? And I just could not wait to ask you about just how elaborate the lower level of Grayskull that was never seen, actually, at least.
It was pretty elaborate. The concept behind it was, if this is the seat of power for all the universe, power is neither good nor bad, it's what you do with it. So I wanted to reflect that duality, and so everything above ground level was, well, we had what we called the space gods, those big, huge bronze sculptures. And then below were the gargoyles and demons and the things that represented everything that was dark and evil and bad. So it's up to the individual whether he's going to use power for good or power for bad. And that's one of the reasons Skeletor was so interesting in controlling that place, is he obviously wanted to use his power for a preserve as a source of goodness in the world that they lived on.
So had they worked their way down, you know, through the sword fight, would we have probably seen He-Man and Skeletor kind of conflicting, you know, I guess with good and evil as they're continuing their big sword fight, you know?
The focus of the fight wouldn't have been my sets. It would have been the two guys. But I designed the sets with the sword fight in mind. I went back and one of my big heroes as production designers was a fellow named Anton Grote, and he designed all the Errol Flynn swashbucklers. So I went back and looked at Captain Blood and Seahawk, and I looked at all the sets that he designed, and I used all the key aspects of those sets to give the actors as much room and stuff to play with as possible, ups and downs, overs and unders, so they could really make a sword fight that was not just great action, but interesting as well, and with lots of places that they can jump off or climb on. They ended up not using it the way I'd hoped to, but it was there for them to use.
So were there any attempts to actually try filming any of the fights at all, or was it pretty much just what we got at the end of the movie, which is, I know Gary has mentioned that they got one day to film like the one-on-one battle, and that was it.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons they didn't really get to fully use the sets the way I designed them, is they just didn't have the time. The Canada cut the production off. Gary begged for one more day and got it, but a lot of the set had already been struck by then, and a lot of it was just shot against black duvetine, sort of in limbo. And that's the reason for it. The set was being struck, and we didn't have the time or money to keep shooting.
Now, I guess when you guys are filming, like I know Canon was in financial crisis when the movie was pretty much greenlit, correct? Like they were starting.
I wish I'd known that.
So you guys really had no idea about that once you guys go into filming, correct? Like that's not like mainstream to everybody working with Canon.
That's right, yeah. No, I had no idea Canon was in such trouble. As far as I knew, they were fine. In fact, the thing that puzzled me and that sort of clued me into that there might be some trouble, and I found out later why this happened, was because we had gone over time and over budget, actually every department except mine had done that, Canon decided to punish us by not having a cast and crew screening, which is, you know, something you get on almost every film. If you worked on the film, you get invited to see a preview of the movie. And so they wouldn't let us have one. So I gathered the art department. I said, let's just go over to the Egyptian theater and pay and go see it, see if what our movie looks like. And I was just amazed we got a beginning, middle, and end. I was astounded. And then I was keeping careful track of the box office, and the first weekend's box office receipts were pretty good. And then typically what happens after that, there's a big drop-off. But with Masters, instead of dropping off, it made even more money the second weekend and more money the third weekend. It was on this trajectory. It was going to make a fortune. And then the fourth week, I believe, is when they pulled it out of theaters. And I was like, why would you pull a film that is making money hand over fist out of the theaters? And what I didn't realize, it was Canon going bankrupt, and they couldn't afford to keep it in the theaters.
Oh, wow. Wow, did not know that about that movie. Because I've heard kind of conflicting things where it sounded like the movie did make money, but not much, or people were saying that it didn't make any money at all.
It would have made a lot if they'd kept it in the theaters.
Wow.
Because it was just growing exponentially by word of mouth.
Boy, thank God you know this stuff, because I feel like the movie over the years has given such a bad reputation for it, and hearing stuff like this too, it just helps constitute that everybody's heart was in the right place in making this movie. But the power
of that,
it just
everybody's on a film for different reasons. Some people are on it because they want to make money. Some they have connections to it. Me. In my naivete, when I got into the film business, I figured that we were all working on the film with the same goal in mind, to make the best film possible. And I found I was really lonely in that regard. People work on films for all different kinds of reasons.
That is amazing, though. That blows my mind too. The thought of that, it could have kept making more and more money, but because they couldn't afford to keep it, they had to pull it. And that just, I've never heard that either. It just, you wonder how well it would have done then if they could have kept it in the theater, and then maybe, you know, people wouldn't have said it was, you know, oh, it didn't do as good as they thought it. It sounded like it was doing great from what you just said, and it could have continued to well. It's just, oh, it's so unfortunate how things happen.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It blew my mind. I was really amazed when they pulled it. And I was amazed that it kept climbing in popularity. And we had a screening recently in Los Angeles, and the place was packed, and the response was just fantastic. I mean, everybody, the audience laughed at all the right parts and cheered at all the right parts. And when He-Man said, "I had the power." I thought the roof was going to come off the theater. The audience went berserk. It was great. And that's exactly what we were hoping to evoke with our film.
Now, were you on set every day for pretty much? Yeah.
Every single day.
Yep. Every single day.
I'm a real hands-on production designer. Obviously, I work designing the film, but I'm always checking things out, making sure my department is running smoothly and that the art department is never holding anything up.
What's like a typical, once you guys have off running, all the designs have been approved and the sets are like, this is what we're going to do. What is a typical day on set when you get up in the morning to the day, to it's time for you to go home? What is the kind of the basic day for you on set?
Well, there is no basic day because, here's a kind of a basic day is on Monday, I will drive. We have the production spread or the people making the stuff for the film, making the vehicles and making the costumes and making everything you can think of. It was spread all over Los Angeles. So I did a lot of driving and I would drive from spot to spot to spot just to make sure everything was going as I envisioned and as scheduled, that they weren't falling behind. And so there was a lot of that all throughout the week. Plus I had departments there at the studio, for instance, the prop department, but I'd have to go to Boss Film, for example. They were making the Cosmic Key for us. And it was mostly just my driving all over the place, making sure everything was going as planned. And then Saturday and Sunday, me drawing furiously and painting like crazy. So I'd have stuff to hand off to all my studio heads or my department heads on Monday morning.
So you're constantly still drawing concepts and changing things. Throughout the entire shoot,
I was designing stuff for the film up until the last 2 weeks of shooting.
That's amazing. Tyler, we should cover some of that, Tyler. Let's talk about some of those things that you did design, whether some made them into the movie or not. But one, for example, Snake Mountain. We know that you came up with your idea of Snake Mountain. Now, obviously, it didn't make it into the movie. I mean, were you pretty upset that they couldn't get Snake Mountain into it? Were you expecting they wouldn't be able to get anything from it? Or, I mean, what were your thoughts on that?
Oh, by that time, I'd done so many films, I was a little bit jaded and was not surprised when major stuff was being cut. Because I went through that on the Conan films and on Red Sonja and First Blood. And so I was used to that. I knew stuff was going to be cut because that's just what always happens. So
now, see,
I don't get precious with the work because I know it's some of it's going to go away.
Okay, because Tyler had kind of a question regarding Snake Mountain. He's almost in a way, I mean, Tyler, why don't you ask him about what you always think about a scene in that movie? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I've waited, like I said, this has been with me for years and years, since I was 4 years old and saw the film.
Uh-huh.
There's a scene, the communications room that Skeletor and Evil Inn are in when they assemble the Evil Warriors.
Yeah.
Is that a location of Snake Mountain, or is that inside Grayskull?
That was inside Grayskull because since we didn't build Snake Mountain, we didn't want to confuse the audience by referencing it. It would have been confusing if we were referencing something the audience never saw. It would only be for the hardcore fans who would even know what we were talking about. So rather than doing that, we avoided confusion by making most of the stuff happen in either the throne room or rooms that were, in theory, adjacent to the throne room. The communications room, that was part of Skeletor's domain. And that was an interesting set for me because we really, for that set, we had almost no money. We needed to have enough throw to do a rear projection, but we were in the wrong size building for that. And so I designed it so that we could do a front projection overhead. And that was where we saw the universe in what we call the Powers of 10 film. And because we didn't have a lot of dough for the film, actually that set is just one wall, and then I took the outer quarters of that wall and bent them in a little bit to suggest that they were in a hexagonal room. And we needed a vehicle for that room, but we didn't have enough money to build a vehicle from scratch, so I took an existing crane and I designed a shell to go over that. So if you watch the film, you'll see a guy on a
Yes.
Well, they called it a Zamboni. But with a big neck and a guy perched in a little capsule. So that was just a standard movie crane, camera crane, that I designed a sandwiching sort of shell to go over it to make it look like it wasn't a crane.
Well, see, I was always convinced that that was something that in Snake Mountain, because it looked from the color scheme to having, you know, the crane or the technician there with Skeletor's Havoc Staff logo on the side of it. It just looked like something that would be in Snake Mountain as opposed to Grayskull. And I
know it's actually, now that you're talking about it, it was in Snake Mountain because it was back in Skeletor's domain because he hadn't taken over the throne room yet. So that was his own domain, and he was using that screen to track where He-Man and the other characters were.
So technically, that was really supposed to be Snake Mountain as opposed to something. I mean, even though you guys are using the same set, story-wise, it's not really mentioned, but pretty much would be considered Snake Mountain. I guess its only appearance kind of in the film.
Yeah. Well, it was in Snake Mountain. I just don't think we ever mentioned Snake Mountain in the dialogue.
That's fantastic. Tyler, you must feel vindication that Tyler has wanted that for years.
Yeah,
I have heard people disregard that very, very, I mean, just for you clarifying that. Oh, my gosh.
That's a first. That's a first. Yeah, it's never been said. That's fantastic.
Yes, finally have had that clarified. I can't wait to go spread the good word on that and point to people's faces and tell them, you know, I was right and you were wrong, and Mr. Stout confirmed it. Eat it.
Did you win some bets?
Say what now?
He said, did you
win some bets?
Oh, well, if I had known I'd be speaking to you at this day and age, I would have made bets a long time ago. because I was so convinced it was Snake Mountain. I know it wasn't because it wasn't mentioned. I just like it's got to be Snake Mountain. Like I just because I know you had done some beautiful concept drawings of like the gates to Snake Mountain, the interior of Snake Mountain, and that throne room drawing you did of like the lava flowing through. Is that Skeletor's throne room in Snake Mountain? Was that what that was supposed to be?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I was sad that they cut that. Although it was going to be really difficult to do the lava. No one has really figured out how to do live lava like that. And it would have been tough. We were experimenting with all different kinds of stuff. And it just wasn't looking real. That's one of the reasons it got cut. The design of that particular room was based a lot on a hotel that Frank Lloyd Wright designed for Tokyo, Japan. I used a lot of the similar design elements because I like that sort of dragon, or the black stone, iridescent black stone, dragon-like, skin-like architectural elements.
It looked beautiful. It looked kind of a lot of your work, too, has definitely, and I know with you and a lot of others, you know, in the 80s, too, that were designing stuff, I mean, it just feels like there's a lot of Conan. And you mentioning that, you know, you did, in fact, work on the two Conan films, Ed Redsaw, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, my gosh. Well, no wonder it shows, because I love all three of those films. And I had no idea that you, especially Red Sonja, because I never hear anybody mention the film. Everyone wants to disregard the film. And I think it's a fantastic film, from sets, costumes, everything.
Well, Red Sonja was originally intended as Conan 3. And Arnold hated the script so much, he said, if you call this character Conan, I won't be in the movie.
Gosh, wow. I find it a bit harsh, because it's not a bad movie at all. I mean, I just never felt it got fair treatment, but it looked great. So I thank you for all the effort you put into that as well.
Sure, that was fun. Mostly on that one, most of what I did was creature design for that.
So you did like the killing machine and things like that?
Any monsters that were in the film, I had a hand in designing those.
Awesome.
Tyler, I was going to say, if you don't mind, when you're speaking about the lava and how you said that no one could even really get it right, and you'd wonder even if it was done how to get it properly because no one still has, it brings me to a question that a lot of fans have always brought up. For me, I never had an issue with this, but a lot of fans were upset. They always said, oh, we didn't get Battle Cat in the movie, or we didn't get Orko. But I always defended this for the longest time. I always said, what could they have possibly done for Battle Cat back in 87. Like you said, you guys had a pretty limited budget, but either way, even if you had a big budget, I was like, what would they have done? I mean, do some animatronic, a limited scene. I mean, could you even envision Battle Cat being done? Did you even want him in the movie? And if he was, how could you even expect, I mean, what would you have expected to Battle Cat to be like, and how limited?
Well, technology was really limited back then. You have to remember that there was no CG back then.
Right.
So if we were going to do Battle Cat justice, it really would have had to have been a combination of puppetry and stop motion animation.
Yes.
Big stop motion fan. I love this work that Ray Harryhausen and Willis O'Brien and Jim Danforth.
I love Harryhausen's work. Clash of the Titans is one of my top films of all time.
So, but stop motion animation takes a long time to do. And we did not have that luxury of that time. We needed to shoot something and get it in the can and get it in the theaters. And so there's just no way that we could have done it and done it justice. The other problem is it was something I pointed out when a lot of the designers were working on new characters for the film. I think originally they wanted to have a character that was sort of humanoid in his body, but he had a sort of a Black Panther head. And I pointed out that, you know, that was going to be really difficult to pull off because people are really familiar with what cats look like. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to see all the flaws. If you instead come up with a character that they've never seen, that is not really based upon anything here on Earth, like Sorog, for example, you fulfilled all their expectations because they don't have any. Right. They're not going to compare Sorog to a Sorog creature living in Africa because there is no such thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas you could compare the Black Panther that we could develop as a makeup and you could compare it to a real Black Panther, and you're going to come up short because everybody knows what a cat looks like and how it moves, and they're going to see the flaws.
And I'm glad. I'm glad you covered that and explained that in depth, because you know people should understand that it, like you said, that's just something that wouldn't have been able to get pulled off properly. I mean, from the cat, you know, man face you were talking about to Battle Cat in general, it's just I don't think that, like you said, first it would have took way too much time doing stop motion. Then if it was just a possible animatronic, the limited time he would have had on screen, I don't think would have even been worth being done. And then I think you would have probably heard fans complain, oh, there wasn't enough Battle Cat, or he looked strange. So, I mean, myself, I never had an issue, but I'm glad you explained it. So hopefully people who always had an issue with that can now understand a little bit better of why he wasn't in the movie.
Yeah, after I did Masters of the Universe, one of the films I worked on was an early version of John Carter of Mars. And that was with John McTiernan was originally going to direct it. The guy did Die Hard and Hunt for Red October.
Was this after Predator or after Die Hard?
This was after Predator. I designed the first Predator for John. And then years later, we worked together on a potential John Carter of Mars, Princess of Mars project. But I was designing suits for camels and elephants. And I was miserable because that's not the way the creatures look like in the Igarus Burroughs novels. But we were saddled with the technology of the time. There's just no way we could have done Thoats and Zitadars and the other creatures from the Burroughs novels and done them justice. And then Jurassic Park came out, and John was very excited because he came back in. He said, we can do everything CG. And I said, John, how much CG do you think was in Jurassic Park? He said, it's all through the movie. You see these dinosaurs everywhere. And I said, yeah, you see the dinosaurs all through the movie, but most of those are Stan Winston's puppets blended with some CG. There was some CG in the film. I said, I think there was about 12 minutes at max of CG in the first Jurassic Park film. And I said, and they took 2 years to do those 12 minutes. And then he got real depressed.
Now, I guess, had you designed, how many characters overall did you design? Like, did Mattel... Because I think Mattel wanted as many characters as they could, but did you really get to pick and choose which of the established characters were going to be in it as opposed to making new ones?
It was all in the script. I think I ended up, let's see, well, of course, it had to have Skeletor and He-Man and Teela and Man-at-Arms. We created Wildor for the film. We created Blade for the film, Sorod, Karg. We knew the Beast Man was going to be in the movie, but I did a redesign of the Beast Man. I wanted to make him basically, the concept was that he came from a tribe of creatures that looked like him. And before he left to join Skeletor, Skeletor is taking like the cream of the warriors from groups that he has control or influence over. And before Beastman left to join Skeletor, his fellow Beastman put their hands in paint and they put their hands on his clothes. So their handprints are on his trousers and clothes. And basically, they're giving him their power to do battle with He-Man. Is a very I liked it. It was a visual way to show that okay, we can't go with you, but we can put my handprint on, and you will have handprint on your armor or your clothes, and you will have our spirits with you to fight He-Man.
That's awesome.
That's a fantastic. Did you do a backstory like that for all the new characters, like Karg and Blade? And so-
I always do that.
Do you have time to?
I mean, even for the regular human characters, like for Courtney Cox's character, I designed her bedroom. And in the dresser drawers, I filled them with the things that she would have, with her clothes, and on the wall, her drawings that she did in high school and things like that. And then I closed the drawers. And, you know, I don't know if in the making of the film and shooting it, if the character is ever going to open those drawers up. But what I did was I stood back and I watched when Courtney first came on the set, and she was looking at all the stuff and looking around and looking at the drawings that her character had done. And then she started opening the drawers and I saw her face light right up. And she said, "This is me. This is all me." And it just made her more into the character that she was supposed to portray, which was the whole point of my doing that. I wanted to make it easy for the actors to imagine that they were those characters. And by adding little details like that, it's a helper.
That's fascinating. I mean, it shows your artistic eye and the vision that you have to giving life to every single character and trying to picture what their life would be. I mean, that's what makes, each person, you know, special, I guess, if you will. Anytime you see some of these people, it's because it seems like there is a life to them. So it's fascinating that you did that. Now, you know, other kind of characters. For one, I had a question about the sorceress in general. Now, she had quite a unique, different design, but I think it was on one of those cards. I have a lot of your art cards for the characters. And was it said that Mobius, one of the ideas, or I'm trying to remember who it was, but if it was Mobius, that the sorceress originally maybe was going to be a 12-year-old girl or something, or was this one of the ideas?
Yes, that was Jean envisioned the sorceress just as a surprise instead of being typically sorceresses. You think, well, to accumulate all that knowledge and power and stuff, they must be very old. And I like the way that John turned it on its head and said, now, what if she looked like if she was 12 years old? Maybe she was 1,200 years old, but looked like she was 12. But okay. I like the idea of surprising the audience. Unfortunately, Mattel didn't go with that. And we had Christina Pickles play the sorceress, and I thought she was terrific. But I really enjoyed designing that costume. That was a joint design between me and Julie Weiss, the costume designer.
Okay, yeah, it definitely, I mean, it was an original, there was never a look of the sorceress like that. I mean, it was, you know, definitely unique, but I mean, it was memorable, and it was one that I think that, you know, fans did start enjoying after, like, you know, they watched the movie a couple more times. Yeah. Because you know how it is, you know, a shock value when you see somebody, you're like, oh God, that doesn't, but then they get into it, which I guess would lead me to another thing is there any character or characters in the movie or any of the designs that you maybe it didn't come across like you wanted, that you wish could have looked another way by chance? Or did you pretty much everything that was created for the movie as for character or characters you thought was pretty spot on?
For the most part it was, but one thing that still irritates the heck out of me to this day is I really hated the design of the stormtroopers. Because to me, they look just like a ripoff of the Star Wars stormtroopers, but instead of being white, they're painted black. Those were not my designs. I did all kinds of other designs to try to get away from that, but that was something that the production insisted upon, and I didn't have the power to sabotage it or say, no, you can't do that.
Was there a reason they didn't let that go? Was there a reason they were so, you know, set on?
I think it's because they love Star Wars so much. It was simply that.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, especially with kind of like the music in a way. You get a kind of a Star Wars Superman feel. So I guess, yeah, I guess
No
they were trying to
kidding.
keep a vibe, huh?
Yeah, when Gary first played me the score with me, because I thought, wait, you're just playing me the Superman score, aren't you?
That's great. Tyler, go ahead, hit him with
So
something.
funny.
Oh, I was very curious to ask, because I know that you work closely with all the actors and kind of building their costumes and things like that, right? That you fitted
Yeah.
them for everything. Now, what was it like working with Frank Langella in designing Skeletor? Because from your drawings, it looks very similar to the toy with its color schemes, and eventually becomes what we see in the film. And I've heard that he played a big part, working with you in developing that, along with working with Gary.
Oh, Frank.
What was that like?
Frank was very, very involved in every aspect of the costume design, and he was very demanding, and I appreciate that because we ended up with what I think is a spectacular costume for Skeletor. The cloak, boy, I wish I had one of those cloaks. The way it moved and everything, because we went through about, well, several different designs for the cloaks until we got one that moved exactly the way that he wanted it to move. And yep, interesting guy to work with, and very thorough, very professional.
And what about like working with Dolph? What was his with his, this being his first starring role as like the leading man? What's it like dealing with somebody like that?
Well, boy, if ever there was a ladies' man, it was Dolph. It was he was extremely, extremely popular amongst the ladies working there on the set.
Oh.
And he was God, he looked fantastic. I thought he was a great choice for He-Man. I think he felt the weight of having to carry that film on his shoulders, and I know he was really concerned about that.
I can imagine so, with it being such a big step for him after playing, the villain in Rocky IV. Now he's like, okay, now you're the star of this big toy movie, and yeah, it's the movie Wrestling. It shows. I guess it's a lot of responsibility. I mean, and hearing about what you were responsible for, I certainly, I'm a junkie to hear backstories about the making of films, what people do, what their job and titles, but. I guess you obviously maintained a pretty cool head, I'd like to think, while you're doing all this, because that's a lot of responsibility just with you alone, of just checking on.
Yeah, 18-hour days, 7 days a week, minimum.
Oh my gosh,
Right.
wow.
That is unreal. And to the amount of characters, again, that you came up with, because that's what we always ate up as, kids, especially, collecting the line. Anytime a new action figure came out, you were just freaking out. So just to see that, three characters from the movie made into toys, it was fantastic. But there's a character that I've always been very curious about. And seeing as, like how you said, you have a lot of backstories, there's a character that wasn't in the movie that I think his name is Warwick, and it looks like he's some kind of like character with bandages, like a sand dune character or something. What is that character exactly? And did he have a backstory?
Yeah, he was, man, I don't remember his function in the script, but he was a desert character. I think initially part of Skeletor's team, and the number of henchmen, but that was a fun thing to design.
Well, I mean, looking online, because I, like I said, I have so many of your cards, but I wanted to research and see if there was other things. And Warwick just popped up online, and he was wrapped in bandages, had like kind of this kind of mask. And I said, "Wow, that looks like some kind of sand warrior or something." So I never knew if he was good or evil or what his intentions were. But I was like, "Man, I wish he would have been in the movie. He seemed very intriguing."
Yeah, me too. But he was definitely evil, or evil. Skeletor was calling upon leaders and warriors from all the different parts of Eternia, and so Warwick came from the desert lands.
Okay, the desert lands. All right, cool. Well, we got a little something there too, because some people, never knew if he was kind of a mummy character, a sand character, but well, I guess, well, now we know he was going to be a sand warrior and an evil one.
Yep.
I guess before we let you go here, be very curious to know like your final thoughts on the film and you know, what could be, what would you like to have improved on or given the opportunity to work on another He-Man film? What is it you would like to see come to fruition?
Well, I'd love to have absolute total control. mostly I just would like to completely redesign the Stormtroopers. That was the big thing that really stuck in my craw. I want everything to be original looking. I don't want people to say, oh, you stole that from Star Wars. That's not the point of making a movie. The point of making a movie is making something that people have never seen and surprising them and exciting them and entertaining them.
You know, that's what gets me excited. You know, Tyler, just pretty much what you just asked, that's what I was going to ask, you know, you too. I was going to say, you know, pretty close to almost 15 years, there's been just, it's a big limbo of, you know, new scripts, new ideas, new directors of a possible Masters of the Universe movie. And it just keeps getting delayed, and nothing happens. So that's why I thought, I mean, if you were given the opportunity, if they asked you to do it, I mean, obviously you'd accept, I'm sure, but that's something that would be fascinating, because with your mind and your visions, now we have the technology these days to do everything. Like you said, there's all the computers that could do special effects that couldn't be done then. I mean, is that something definitely that you would be interested in if they ever asked you, hey, William, you know, would you like to work with us?
Oh, I'd love to do it. I think it'd be fantastic. Plus, you know, since Masters, I've worked on another 30 or more films. So I've got all that extra experience under my belt, and I just have a greater knowledge of what can be done film-wise and drama-wise, and I'd have a blast doing a new Masters of the Universe movie. I'd really, really enjoy that.
I think me and Tyler are going to have to start a petition then, huh, Tyler? We're going to have to do another one of these and see about support to get William Stout to come back and bring Masters alive once again for a new generation.
Yeah, this man needs to be directing it, you know, creating the designs, everything. Just give him full control of it and just let him run with it, man, because he's, you know, William, you had the best eye for creating all these characters that we know and love and updating them and giving us new characters. So you, all the thorough backstories that you gave to all these characters, it's incredible. I mean, all the attention to detail that you put on there, it's, you know, I just can't thank you enough for all that you put into it, because it really has had an incredibly lasting impression on me since I first saw it. And as I get older, I would pick apart things. I would just like, wow, they did that really well. And I like that even more. And I just would appreciate more and more. That's why I would start looking at stuff at the interior of Grayskull and looking at all the things on Sarad's outfit, you know, and all the attention to details. Like, dear God, man, there's so many great things in this. It ages like fine wine, the movie does to me.
Oh, thank you. I like to make movies that are visually layered, so you can go back and see them again and again and again and notice new things each time you see them. For me, that's a really fun aspect of designing a film is putting all kinds of little things in there that the audience may not catch the first time. Maybe they catch it the second or third time they see the film.
Every time. It's been like that. Even I've watched it on VHS so many times, to DVD, and now on Blu-ray, and still noticing things. You know, we're approaching the 30th anniversary and when 2017 comes around, and I'm still picking up on details. How did I miss that? It's like that all the time. But it's a film I've studied so much just because I adore it. It's just been, I don't know life without the movie. I've seen it so many times. So it's an extraordinary film, and all the efforts are just, as you can see behind me, well loved and cherished.
Wow.
I guess in closing, where can fans, you know, where can they see more of your work or contact you and thank you for all you've done? I mean, where can fans, you know, see more about you?
Well, my website is williamstout.com. That's pretty easy to remember. And I've got a variety of things on the site. I've also got a shop on my site. You can buy my books and prints and posters and toys and stuff. And right now I'm working on a huge book. It's a big career retrospective that will come out in about 2 years from Inside Editions. And it'll have some Masters of the Universe work in there.
Awesome.
But I'm hoping to put out a big book or a two-volume set on just my film design, because I've certainly got enough material to fill two huge books on that. And I would love to show in greater detail the majority of my Masters of the Universe designs, the ones that haven't been printed yet, because I've got, I've got drawers and drawers and drawers full of those designs that have never been seen by the public.
Oh, wow, we need to see that.
Oh, you have to make that public, William. Like, we can start one of those we can start funding money. You can go fund me's or whatever. we'll do it for you.
Yeah, when that book comes out, yeah, definitely we're there to buy that. That's something we'll look forward to. Oh God, now you just got excited. No, yeah, Tyler, we're gonna have to head over there right now. We'll help you clean out your drawers and or organize them and make the book with you. Whatever you want, we're there to help.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
okay. That's great. You know, we should do this again because, you know, obviously we've run out of time. I got to go
Yes. Babysit
the grandkids. But we got lots more we can talk about. If you want to set up another chat, let's do that.
Well, really? You'd love to come back? Because I got tons of more questions. I know Joe does. And I mean, I could have talked the full 8 hours with you had we been allowed.
Yeah. I think we just scratched the surface. There's a lot of stuff.
Well, we'll definitely have you back.
Well,
I
think it goes without saying. We can set something up. If you're willing to come back, by all means. Okay. It's a dream come true to have you on here. So, absolutely, we got to have a sequel.
Yeah, heck yeah. I'll try to dig up some drawings that I can hold up in front of the camera, so you can see some of the stuff that hasn't been printed yet.
Oh wow!
We could do that, with 2017 coming up and the 30th anniversary. This would be a great way of commemorating it 30 years later.
Oh, yeah.
Of showing this stuff to the public for the first
time. Wow, 30 years ago. That's amazing.
Time flies.
Joe, do you have anything else to add here to Bill here, but I guess before we let him go? Or?
Well, I want to say, I mean, it was a pleasure having you on. We're so thankful that you joined us. I mean, you gave us so much information that we never knew, found out a lot of new things. And obviously from what you just said about all this material that you have that you can create a book with and things that we never seen, everybody will look forward to that. I mean, we're definitely going to look forward to having you on again. And when you show some of this stuff, I mean, that'll be another first. But, no, I mean, it was a pleasure. Like I said, this movie, it's brought a lot of joy to me and Tyler and a lot of the Masters of the Universe fans out there. So I'm sure they appreciate you, you know, sharing all this information with them as well.
All righty. I'll leave you with a little teaser. Oh. Robbie's Ribs and Chicken was actually shot at a real fast food place, but I designed plugs and stuff and signage to go over it to change the way it looked. It has become extremely famous and notorious for a historical event that occurred there after we shot there. And I'll tell you what that is the next time we talk.
Okay.
Oh boy.
That sounds interesting.
Find that out.
Okay.
So we have official sequel lined up with William Stout here. So This is fantastic news here. So we got a teaser going into our second interview with him. So this is great news.
All right.
To all of our listeners, we hope you enjoyed the first part because we definitely are going to have William back to do an even bigger discussion on the film here. And we hope you enjoyed it. We certainly enjoyed William. Thank you, sir, for taking time.
Thank you guys. And boy, and thanks to all the fans for showing all that support for the film over the years. It's really, really appreciated.
Yes.
We thank you. The whole point is we really want to keep pushing the positive word about this film. Cause I'd spend all my days just promoting the hell out of this film and making sure that people see it for the great film that it is, from the details to the story, everything. So we thank you for all your efforts and we can't wait to have you back.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it too. I'll see you guys later.
All right. Oh, later.
All right, guys, and don't forget you can call our 24-hour voicemail line. Leave us a voicemail message up to 10 minutes in length. It's area code 217-953-4025. Thanks for watching.